The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 6, Side 1.
Up to the age of 18, she was in ordinary camps, and from the age of 18 on, she was in special camps. For her directness and her language, she got a second camp sentence, and, it seems, a third one as well. Zoya's parents had already been freed, and her brothers too. But Zoya languished on in camp. Long live our tolerance of religion. Long live our children, the masters of communism. And let any country speak up that can say it has loved its children as we have ours. Chapter 18. The Muses in Gulag. It was an accepted saying that everything is possible in Gulag. The blackest foulness, any twist and turn of betrayal, wildly unexpected encounters, love on the edge of the precipice. Everything was possible. But if anybody should ever try to tell you with shining eyes that someone was re-educated by government means through the KVCH, the Cultural and Educational Section, you can reply with total conviction, nonsense. Everyone in Gulag was re-educated under one another's influence and by circumstances, re-educated in various directions. But not even one juvenile, let alone any adult, was re-educated by means of the KVCH. However, so that our camps might not be like dens of depravity, communes of brigandage, nurseries of recidivists, and conductors of immorality, this is how Tsarist prisons were described, they were equipped with such an appendage as the Cultural and Educational Section. Because, as was said by the then head of Gulag, I. Apeter, to the prison construction of capitalist countries, the proletariat of the USSR counterposes its cultural, and not its camp, construction. Those institutions in which the proletarian state enforces deprivation of freedom can be called prisons or by some other name. It is not a matter of terminology. These are places where life is not killed off, but instead gives forth new shoots. I don't know how Apeter ended. There is a great likelihood, I think, that they soon wrung his neck, too, in those very places in which, as he said, life gives off new shoots. But it is not a matter of terminology. Has the reader now understood what the main thing was in our camps? Cultural construction. And for every need, an organ was created and multiplied, and its tentacles reached out to every island. In the 20s, they were called PVCHs, Political Educational Sections, and from the 30s on, KVCHs. They were supposed, in part, to replace the former prison priests and prison religious services. Here is how they were organized. The chief of the KVCH was a free employee with the authority of an assistant to the chief of camp. He picked out his own instructors, the norm was one instructor to 250 wards, who had to be from strata close to the proletariat, which means, of course, that intellectuals, the petty bourgeoisie, were unsuitable. It was more decent for them to be swinging a pick. So they recruited as instructors thieves with two or three convictions, urban swindlers, embezzlers, and seducers along with them. And so it was that a young fellow had kept himself sort of clean and who had got 5 years for rape with mitigating circumstances might roll up his newspaper and go off to the barracks of the 58s to lead a little discussion on the role of labour in the process of correction. The instructors had a particularly good outside view of that role because they themselves had been released from the productive process. Similar such socially friendly elements made up the activists group of the KVCH, but the activists were not released from work. They could only hope that in time they would be able to do in one of the instructors and take over his job. This created a generally friendly atmosphere in the KVCH. In the mornings, the instructor had to see the Zeks off to work. Then he would inspect the kitchen, that is, he would be well fed, and then he would go to catch up on his sleep in his cabin. He would be ill-advised to tangle with or touch the thief ringleaders, Because in the first place it was dangerous, and in the second place the moment would come when criminal cohesion would be transformed into a productive cohesion. And at that point the thief ringleaders would lead the shock brigades into storm assaults. And so for the time being, let them too just sleep it off after their night-long card games. But the instructors are constantly guided in their activity by the general overall thesis that cultural and educational work in the camps is not cultural and educational work with unfortunates, but cultural and productive work with a knife edge. We just can't get along without that knife edge. Directed against, yes, you've guessed it, against the 58s. Alas, the KVCH does not have the right to arrest. Now, this was such a limitation on its cultural opportunities, but could make a request to the administration, which would not refuse. And besides, the instructor systematically presents reports on the mood of the Zeks. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear. At this point, the cultural and educational section delicately shades into the security section, but this is not spelled out in the instructions. However, we see that, carried away by our quotations, we have grammatically slipped into the present tense. We have to disappoint the reader with the fact that the matter concerns the 30s, the finest, most flourishing years of the KVCH, when a classless society was being built in the country, and when there had not yet occurred the awful outburst of class struggle that did occur the moment that society was achieved. In those glorious years, the KVCH expanded into many important appendages: the cultural councils of those deprived of freedom, cultural and educational commissions, sanitary and living conditions commissions, shock brigade staffs, inspection posts for fulfillment of the production and financial plan, etc. Well, as Comrade Soltz, the curator of the Belamore Canal and chairman of the Commission of the VTSIK on particular amnesties, said, even the prisoner in prison must live by what the whole country is living by. That foul enemy of the people, Soltz, was justly punished by proletarian justice. I beg your pardon, that fighter for the great cause, Comrade Soltz, was slandered and perished in the years of the cult. Oh, I beg your pardon, at the time of the insignificant phenomenon of the cult. And how variegated and varied were the forms of work, like life itself, organization of competition, organization of shock worker movements, struggle for fulfillment of the production and financial plan, struggle for labor discipline, storm assault on the liquidation of hold-ups, cultural crusades, voluntary collection of funds for airplanes, subscription to loans, voluntary Saturdays for strengthening the defense capabilities of the country, exposure of fake shock workers, conversations with malingerers, liquidation of illiteracy. They went unwillingly. Professional and technical courses for camp inmates from among the workers. The thieves pushed hard to learn to be drivers. Freedom. And fascinating lectures on the inviolability of socialist property, and simply reading the newspapers aloud, evenings of questions and answers, and red corners in every barracks, graphs of fulfillment of plan, statistics on goals, and what posters, what slogans. In this happy time, the muses soared over the gloomy expanses and chasms of the archipelago, and the first and highest muse among them was Polyhymnia, the muse of hymns and of slogans. The brigade that excels gets praise and respect. Do your shock work, get time off your sentence. Or, work hard, your family waits for you at home. You see how clever this is psychologically. After all, what do you have here? First, if you have forgotten about your family, this will start you worrying about them and remind you of them. Second, if you are intensely alarmed, it will calm you down. Your family exists and has not been arrested. And in the third place, your family does not need you just for your own sake, but needs you only through conscientious camp work. Lastly, let's join in the shock assault in honor of the 17th anniversary of the October Revolution. Who could resist that? Then there were theatricals with politically relevant themes, a little bit from the Muse Thalia. For example, the servicing of the Red Calendar, or the Living Newspaper, or propaganda mock trials, or oratorios on the theme of the September plenum of the Central Committee in 1930, or a musical skit, the March of the Articles of the Criminal Code. Article 58 was a lame Baba Yaga. How this all brightened the life of the prisoners and helped them reach upward toward the light. And the recreation directors of the KVCH, and then the atheistic work too, the choirs and glee clubs under the shade of the Muse Euterpe. And then those propaganda brigades. The shock workers swing their shoulders, hurrying with their wheelbarrows. You see what bold self-criticism this is. They were not even afraid to touch on the shock workers. In fact, it was quite enough for a propaganda brigade to come to a penalty sector and give a concert there. Listen, listen, Roper Volga, night and day beside the Zex, on the site stand the Czechists. What that means is, never fear. Workers have a strong, strong arm. The Ogpu men are communists. This was in Yugoda's day. And all the penalty workers, and in particular the recidivists, would throw down their playing cards and rush off to work immediately. And there were other measures as well. A group of the best shock workers would visit a strict regimen company or a penalty isolator and take a propaganda brigade with them. At the beginning, the shock workers would reproach and shame the malingerers, explain to them the advantages of fulfillment of the work norms. They would get better rations. And then the propaganda brigade would sing, "Everywhere the battles call, and the Moscow-Volga canal conquers snow and cold." And then, with total frankness, "And so that we'll live better, in order to eat, in order to drink, we have to dig the ground better." And they invited all volunteers not only to return to the compound, but to transfer immediately into a shock workers' barracks from the penalty barracks, where they would be fed right on the spot. What an artistic success! The propaganda brigades, except for the central one, were not released from work themselves. They got an extra portion of grits on the days of their performances. And what about more delicate types of work? For example, the struggle with the aid of the prisoners themselves against equalizing wages. You just have to ponder what a profound thought is contained here. This means that at a brigade meeting, a prisoner would stand up and say, "Don't give him a full ration, he worked badly. You'd do better to give the 7 ounces to me instead." Or the comrades' courts? In the first years after the revolution, these were called moral comrades, and they embraced games of chance, fights, thefts. But were these really a business for a court? And the word moral smelled the high heaven of bourgeois morality, and it was abrogated. From the period of Reconstruction, from 1928, these courts began to deal with absenteeism, with simulating illness, a poor attitude toward inventory, spoiled production, spoilage of materials. And so long as hostile class elements among the prisoners did not worm their way into the comrades' courts, and only murderers, thieves converted to bitches, embezzlers and bribe-takers appeared there, the courts, in their sentencing, would petition the camp chief for such penalties as deprivation of visits, food parcels, time off sentence, release on parole, and the dispatch of incorrigibles on prisoner transports. What reasonable, fair measures these were, and how particularly useful it was that the initiative in applying them came from the prisoners themselves, though not, of course, without certain difficulties. They commenced the trial of a former kulak in a comrade's court, and he said, "You have a comrade's court, and to you I'm a kulak, not a comrade, so you have no right to judge me." They were thrown into confusion. They consulted the political education section of the chief administration of corrective labor camps, and received the reply, try him, don't fool around." What was the foundation of foundations of all the cultural and educational work in camp? don't leave the camp inmate to himself after work so he will not revert to his former criminal tendencies. Well, for example, so that the 58s wouldn't start thinking about politics. It was important that the prisoner should never get out from under the educational influences. And in this regard, advanced modern technical devices were very helpful, and in particular the loudspeakers on every pillar and in every barracks. They must never fall silent. They must explain to the prisoners constantly and systematically from reveille until taps how to advance the hour of freedom. They reported every hour on the course of the work, on the leading and lagging work brigades, on those who were hindering. And one could recommend another original format, a conversation on the radio with individual malingerers and slackers. Well, and there was the press, of course, the press, the sharpest weapon of our party. Now this was the real proof that in our country there was freedom of the press, the existence of a press in prisons. Yes, in what other country was it still possible for prisoners to have their own press? First, there were handwritten wall newspapers, and second, mimeographed or printed ones. And in both cases, they had fearless camp correspondents who scourged faults of the prisoners. And this self-criticism was encouraged by the leadership. The extent to which the leadership itself attributed significance to the free camp press is indicated even by Order 434 of Dmitlag. The overwhelming majority of the criticisms aroused no response. The newspapers also published photos of the shock workers. The newspapers pointed the finger. The newspapers disclosed. The newspapers also exposed the sallies of the class enemy, so he could be hit harder. The newspaper was the best collaborator of the security section. And overall, the newspapers reflected the flow of camp life and are invaluable testimony for descendants. Here, for example, is the newspaper of the Archangel Prison in 1931, and it depicts for us the bounty and prosperity in which the prisoners were living. Cuspidors, ashtrays, oilcloth on the tables, radio loudspeakers, portraits of the leaders, and slogans on the walls speaking vividly of the general party line. These are the well-earned fruits which those deprived of freedom enjoy. Yes, dear fruits. And how did this affect the lives of those deprived of freedom? The same paper, half a year later. Everyone has set to work energetically. The fulfillment of the production and financial plan has risen. The food has decreased and worsened. Well, that's all right. That, as it happens, is all right. The last element could be corrected. So far, the materials for this chapter have been drawn from the collection of articles edited by Vyshinsky, Opsit, and from Averbach, Opsit. And where, oh where, has all that gone? Oh, how transitory everything beautiful and perfect is on earth. Such an intensive, hearty, optimistic system of education of the merry-go-round type, flowing from the very sources of the progressive teaching, promising that within a few years, not one single criminal would be left in our country. On November the 30th, 1934, it particularly seemed like that. And where, then? All of a sudden the Ice Age set in, which of course was very necessary and absolutely indispensable, and all the petals of those tender beginnings were scattered to the winds. And where did the shock worker movement and socialist competition disappear to? And the camp newspapers? Storm assaults, collections of funds, subscriptions to loans, and unpaid Saturdays, cultural councils and comrades' courts, literacy drives and technical courses. What did it matter when they even issued orders that the portraits of the party leaders and the loudspeakers should be removed from the camp compounds? And they didn't go putting any more cuspidors around either. And how the life of the prisoners suddenly paled. How it was suddenly thrown back whole decades, deprived of the most important revolutionary prison gains. But we are not protesting. The measures of the party were both timely and very much needed. No longer was the artistic, poetical form of slogans valued, and the slogans, too, were now only the simplest. Fulfill. Over-fulfill. Of course, no one undertook to forbid directly aesthetic indoctrination or the fluttering of the muses, but the possibilities for this were greatly narrowed. Here, for example, is one of the camp compounds in Vorkuta. The nine-month winter came to an end, and the unreal, three-month-long, somehow pitiful summer set in. The chief of the KVCH was pained because the camp compound looked foul and dirty. In such conditions, a criminal could not properly meditate on the perfection of the system from which he had excluded himself. So the KVCH proclaimed several working Sundays. In their free time, the prisoners took great pleasure in making some flower beds, not out of anything growing, for nothing would grow there, but instead of planting flowers, they just decorated dead mounds skillfully with mosses, lichens, broken glass, crushed stone, slag, and broken-up brick. And then around these flower beds, they set up little fences made of plasterer's lath. Though it turned out to be not quite so beautiful as the Gorky Park, nonetheless the cultural and educational section was satisfied. Were you going to say that in 2 months' time the rains would fall and wash it all away? Well, so what? They would wash it away. Next year we will do it all over again. Or what did the political chats turn into? A lecturer came to Unschlag No. 5 from Sukhobezvodny, this in 1952. After work, the Zeks were herded to the lecture. The comrade, it is true, had no secondary education, but he delivered a necessary and topical lecture, which was fully correct politically. On the struggle of the Greek patriots. The Zeks sat there sleepily, hiding behind each other's backs, without the slightest interest in it. The lecturer described the awful persecutions of the patriots and related how the Greek women, in tears, had written a letter to Comrade Stalin. The lecture came to an end, and Sheremeta, a woman from Lvov, who was simple-minded but cunning, rose and asked him, "Citizen Chief, tell me, who should we write to?" And by this the positive influence of the lecture was reduced to zero. The types of correctional and educational work which the KVCH retained were these. To a prisoner's petition to the camp chief, they would add a notation on norm fulfillment and conduct. They would deliver to the various rooms letters released by the censor. They would bind newspapers in a file and hide them from the Zeks so they couldn't use them for cigarette paper. 3 times a year they gave amateur theatrical programs. They procured paints and canvas for artists, so the latter could provide decorations for the camp compound and paint paintings for the chief's apartments. And then they would help the security chief a bit, but that was unofficial. After this, it is not surprising that the workers of the KVCH themselves were not flaming, bold leaders, but for the most part dimwits and sad sacks. Yes, there was one more important type of work which they did. Maintaining the boxes. They had to be opened at intervals, cleaned out and locked up again. Small, brownish-coloured boxes hung in a prominent place in the compound. On the boxes were labels. To the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. To the Council of Ministers of the USSR. To the Minister of Internal Affairs. To the Prosecutor General. Go ahead and write. You have freedom of speech here, and we will decide what goes to whom. There are special comrades here to read it. What is put into these boxes? Petitions asking pardon? Not only. Sometimes denunciations, too, from beginners. The KVCH sorts out that they are not to go to Moscow, but to the office next door. And what else? Well, the inexperienced reader is not going to guess. There were also inventions. The greatest inventions intended to turn all modern technology upside down, or at any rate to liberate their inventors from camp. There are many more inventors, as also poets, among plain, ordinary people than we imagine, and in camp especially. One has to try to get released, right? Invention is a form of escape which doesn't involve the risk of a bullet or a beating. At line-up before work and after, with hand barrows and picks, these servitors of the muse Urania, she is the closest you can come, wrinkle their brows and strive to invent something to astound the government and fire its greed. Here is Lebedev, a radio operator from the Kovrino camp. Now that he has been turned down, there is nothing more to hide, and he admits to me that he discovered a deviation of the compass needle from the odor of garlic. From this he had envisioned a way to modulate high-frequency waves with an odor, and thereby transmit an odor over a great distance. However, government circles did not see any military advantage in this project and were not interested. That meant it didn't come off. Either go on bending your back or think up something better. One or another fellow, true very rarely, would be suddenly taken off somewhere. He would not explain or say anything himself so as not to spoil things, and no one in the camp could figure out why this particular person had been taken off somewhere. One might disappear forever, and another might be brought back after a time. He would still not say what it was about so as not to become a laughingstock. Or he would put on an air of great mystery. This, too, was typical of the Zeks, telling something to exaggerate their importance. But having myself been on the islands of paradise, I had had the opportunity of seeing both ends of the pipeline, where this got to, and how they read things there. And here I am going to allow myself to amuse the patient reader of this not-so-very cheery book. There was a certain Trushlyakov, formerly a Soviet lieutenant, shell-shocked in Sevastopol, taken prisoner there, dragged subsequently through Auschwitz, and as a result of all this, a little touched. He managed to propose from camp something so intriguing that it led to his being brought to a scientific research institute for prisoners, that is, a Sharashka. There he proved to be a genuine fountain of inventions, and no sooner had the chiefs rejected one of them than he immediately proposed the next. And even though he did not get even one of these inventions to the calculating stage, he was so inspired, so impressive, spoke so little, and had such an expressive look, that not only did no one dare suspect him of swindling, but one of my friends, a very serious engineer, insisted that in the profundity of his ideas, Trushlyakov was the 20th century Newton. I, it is true, did not follow up on all his ideas to the very end, but he was entrusted with working out and preparing a radar absorber, which he himself had proposed. He demanded help in higher mathematics, and as a mathematician I was assigned to him. Here is how Trushlyakov set forth his idea. In order not to reflect radar waves, a plane or a tank must be covered with a certain material made up of many separate layers. What sort of material this was, Trushlyakov never told me. Either he had not yet selected it, or else this was the inventor's main secret. The electromagnetic wave had to lose all its energy through the multiple refractions and reflections back and forth at the edges of these layers. And now, without knowing the characteristics of the material, yet making use of the laws of geometrical optics and any other means available to me, I was supposed to prove that everything would work out as Trushlyakov had predicted, and in addition select the optimal number of layers. Naturally, I could do nothing. Nor did Trushlyakov do anything either. Our creative alliance collapsed. Soon afterward, Trushlyakov brought me in my capacity as librarian. I was also librarian there. A requisition for an interlibrary loan from the Lenin Library. Without indicating authors or publications, the requisition consisted of the following. Something relating to the technology of interplanetary travel. Since we were only in the year 1947 at the time, the Lenin Library had almost nothing to offer him other than Jules Verne. People thought little of Tsiolkovsky at that time. After an unsuccessful attempt to set up a flight to the moon, Trushlyakov was expelled thence into the abyss, back to camp. But the letters kept coming and coming. I was subsequently attached, this time as a translator, to a group of engineers investigating the piles of claims to inventions and patents coming in from the camps. A translator was required because many of the documents arriving in 1946 and 1947 were in German. But these were not claims to patents, and they were not voluntary compositions either. It was shameful and painful to read them. They had been extorted, exacted, sweated out of German war prisoners. For it was clear that we could not succeed in holding these prisoners as war prisoners for all eternity. It might be 3 years, or it might be 5 after the end of the war. But sooner or later they would have to be released nach der Heimat. It was therefore necessary during the years they were here to squeeze out everything which could be useful to our country. We had to try to get even this pale reflection of those German patents that had been carted off to the western zones. I could easily picture how it had been done. The unsuspecting and dependable Germans were instructed to report their fields of specialization, where they had worked, and in what capacity. Then, naturally, the security operations third section summoned all the engineers and technicians into their office one at a time. They were first questioned with respectful attention, this flattered the Germans, about the kind and nature of their pre-war work in Germany. They had already begun to think that perhaps they would be given more privileged work instead of camp work. Then a signed agreement on non-disclosure was required of them. And once something is verboten to a German, he will not violate it. And finally they were confronted with a harsh demand to set forth in writing all the interesting details of their field of production and describe any important technical innovations used there. Then the Germans came to realize belatedly what kind of trap they had been caught in by bragging about their former jobs. But they could not just write nothing at all now, for they were threatened in that event with never being allowed to return to their motherland. And in those years this seemed quite likely. With tormented consciences, depressed, barely pushing their pens, the Germans wrote. The only thing that saved them and enabled them to avoid giving away serious secrets was the fact that the ignorant security officers were incapable of fathoming the true nature of their testimony and valued it according to the number of pages. And we, going through it, were hardly ever able to find anything substantial. The information was either contradictory or buried in a scientific fog with omission of the main thing, or else they seriously described technical innovations of a type well known to our grandfathers. But the claims to patents in Russian, what servility they sometimes reeked of, once again one can easily picture how these were written, how, there in camp, on a pitiful free Sunday, the authors of these claims carefully hid what they were writing from their neighbors, probably lying and saying they were writing petitions for pardon. Nor could their dim minds foresee that it was not the lazy, well-fed leadership that would read their calligraphy addressed to the sovereign, but plain ordinary zecs like themselves. And we leafed through 16 big pages, paper begged from the KVCH, of the most detailed proposals. 1. On the use of infrared rays for guarding camp compounds. 2. On the use of photoelectric elements for counting the number of prisoners departing through the gatehouse. And the son of a bitch included drawings too, and technical elucidations. And the preamble was as follows. Dear Yosif Vissarionovich, even though I have been sentenced for my crimes under Article 58 to a long term of imprisonment, even here I remain devoted to my beloved Soviet government and wish to assist in the secure guarding of the fierce enemies of the people who surround me. If I am summoned from the camp and receive the necessary means, I guarantee to make this system work. Now this was a political for you. This treatise went from hand to hand among us, amid exclamations and obscenities. All of us there were zecs. One of us sat down to write a review of the project. The project was technically illiterate. The project did not take into consideration. The project did not provide for. Unprofitable, unreliable. It could lead to a weakening rather than a strengthening of camp guard. What are you dreaming of today, Judas, at your distant camp? I'll shove a pole down your throat. Drop dead rat. And here came a packet from Vorkuta. The author complains that the Americans have an atomic bomb, and our motherland hasn't. He writes that at Vorkuta he often ponders this fact, and that up there, behind barbed wire, he wishes to help the party and the government. And therefore he heads his project DAN. Disintegrating the atomic nucleus. But he has not perfected this project, a familiar picture, because of the lack of technical literature at the Vorkuta camp. As if there were any other literature there either. And this savage merely asks us to send him in the meantime instructions on radioactive disintegration. after which he will undertake to complete his project for Dan. Behind our desks we roll with laughter and almost simultaneously come to the same vulgar evaluation.
This here Dan is a blanking sham.
And meanwhile, really great scientists were done in and perished in camps. But the leadership of our dear ministry was in no hurry to seek them out there and find worthier uses for them. Alexander Leonidovich Chishevsky served his whole term without ever being in a shurashka. Even before camp, Chishevsky was very much out of favour in our country because he had found a connection between revolutions on Earth, biological processes on Earth, and solar activity. His scientific scope was out of the ordinary. The problems he concerned himself with were unexpected and did not fit into the convenient, accepted classifications of the world of science, and it was not clear how they could be put to use for military and industrial purposes. Today, after his death, we read articles praising him. He established that the incidence of myocardial thrombosis is 16 times greater during electrical storms. He correctly predicted flu epidemics. He was in quest of a technique for the early discovery of cancer based on the graph of the subsidence reaction of red corpuscles. And he advanced the hypothesis of zeta radiation from the sun. The father of Soviet space navigation, Korolev, was, to be sure, taken into a shurashka, but as an aviation scientist. The shurashka administration did not allow him to work on rockets, and he had to do that work at night. We don't know whether L. Landau would have been taken into a shurashka or shipped off to distant islands. He had already confessed, with a broken rib, to being a German spy, but was saved by the intervention of P. Kapitsa. Konstantin Ivanovich Strakhovich, the great Russian specialist in aerodynamics and an extraordinarily versatile scientific mind, after travelling on a prisoner transport from the Leningrad prison, became an auxiliary worker in the bath of the Uglich camp. He now relates the whole story with his innocent childish laugh, which he amazingly retained throughout his whole tenure. After several months in a death cell, he then survived a serious attack of dysentropic diarrhea in camp. After that, they assigned him to guard the entrance to the soaping room when the women's brigades were taking baths. They had to assign stronger people to deal with the men. He couldn't have handled it. His task was to be sure that the women entering the soaping room wore nothing and had empty hands, so that everything went to the fumigator, most of all the bras and panties, which the medical section considered the chief centres of lice infestation, and which the women tried particularly hard not to turn in and attempted to take through the bath with them. And Strakhovich looked like this. He had a Lord Kelvin beard and a forehead like a craggy cliff, with a brow double the ordinary height. You could hardly call it a forehead at all. The women pleaded with him and insulted him and grew angry at him and laughed at him and invited him to accompany them to a pile of twig brooms in the corner. Nothing moved him, and he was merciless. Then they unanimously and maliciously nicknamed him the Impotent. And suddenly one fine day the authorities came and took this Impotent off to be in charge of no more and no less than the first turbojet engine project in the country. But of those scientists who were allowed to die at general work, we know nothing. And as for those arrested and destroyed in the heat of scientific discovery, like Nikolai Mikhailovich Orlov, who back in 1936 had worked out a method for the long-term preservation of foodstuffs, how are we to find out about them? After all, their discoveries were shut down following the arrest of the man who made them. In the fetid, oxygenless atmosphere of the camps, the sooty flame of the KVCH would sputter and flare up, casting the merest glimmer. But people would be drawn from various barracks and from various brigades, even to this little flame. Some came with a direct purpose, to tear paper from a book or newspaper to make a smoke, to get paper for a petition, or to write with the ink there. Ink was not permitted in the barracks, and here, too, it was kept under lock and key. After all, ink can be used to forge rubber stamps. And some came just to put on airs, see how cultured I am. And some to rub elbows and chatter with new people, someone other than their boring fellow brigade mates. And some came to listen to the others and report to the Godfather. But there were others still who didn't themselves know why they were inexplicably drawn there for a short evening half hour, tired as they were, instead of lying on their bunks, allowing their aching bodies to rest a little. These visits to the KVCH brought the soul a mite of refreshment in imperceptible and unobvious ways, even though those who stopped by were altogether the same sort of hungry zecs as the ones who stayed sitting on their brigade multiple bunks. Here they didn't talk about rations, nor of portions of cereal, nor about norms. People here didn't talk about the things that made up camp life, and therein lay a protest of the heart and some relaxation for the mind. Here they talked about some kind of fabulous past, which just could not have existed for these grey, famished, bedraggled people. Here, too, they talked about the indescribably blessed, free-moving life, out in freedom, of those fortunates who had somehow succeeded in not landing in prison. And people also talked about art here, sometimes so magically. It was as if someone, when an evil spirit was raging, had drawn on the ground a weakly gleaming and foggily flickering circle, and it was just about to go out, but as long as it hadn't, you could at least imagine that within that circle, for those half hours, you were not in the power of the evil force. Yes, and then, too, someone would sometimes be plucking at a guitar. Someone would be softly singing, a song that was not at all the kind permitted on the stage. And something would stir within you. Life exists. It exists. And looking happily around you, you, too, would want to express something to someone. However, speak only guardedly. Listen, but keep pinching yourself. Take Leover G. Blanken. He was an inventor, and a student who had not completed the course in the Auto Engineering Institute. He was planning to increase the efficiency of motors, but they took all his notes away when they searched his place. He was also an actor, and we were putting on Chekhov's The Proposal with him. He was a philosopher, too, and was adept at such cute expressions as, "I don't want to worry about future generations. Let them scratch around in the earth for themselves. I myself cling to life just like this." He demonstrated by gripping the wood of the table with his fingernails. "Believe in lofty ideas? That's something to be said into a telephone with the wire pulled out. History is a disconnected chain of facts. Give me back my tail. An amoeba is more perfect than a human being. It has simpler functions." If you listened to him, he would explain in detail why he hated Lev Tolstoy, why he was intoxicated by Ilya Ehrenberg and Alexander Grin. He was also an obliging chap who didn't avoid hard work. He would hammer away at a wall with a cold chisel. True, in a brigade guaranteed 140% of norm. His father had been arrested and had died in 1937, but he himself was a non-political offender, imprisoned for forging bread ration cards. However, he was ashamed of his own swindling article and tried to get closer to the 58s. He tried and tried to get closer, but then one day some camp trials began, and this oh-so-pleasant and interesting lad, clinging to life, Leover G. Blanken, testified as a witness for the prosecution. And all those who cling to life too hard never particularly cling to the spirit. And it was a good thing if you hadn't said too much to him. If there were eccentrics in camp, and there always were, they could not avoid dropping in on the KVCH. They were bound to look in. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.